Welcome to Geek Speak, bridging the gaps between geeks and the rest of humanity. My name's Lyle Troxell. Please keep in mind the views expressed during Geek Speak are not necessarily those of KUSP. Today on Geek Speak, supercomputers built by people that don't know each other. During the second half of the show, I'll welcome you to join our conversation. The numbers are 476-2800 or toll free at 1-800-655-5877. Or you can go to geekspeak.org, click on the geeks, and click on send a message. I'll give out that information again when I invite your participation in about a half an hour. I just love that theme song. You're listening to Geek Speak. The geeks this morning, Sean Cleveland, Miles Elam, and John Tracy. My name's Lyle Troxell. Welcome, geeks, to Geek Speak.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Miles, we're going to start with your smiling face. Before we get into our discussion about flash mobs and supercomputing, let's talk with you about news.
One of the technologies that's come up in the past was a degrading DVD. In other words, one that when you...
Just yelled at you? Sorry.
Say, for example, you, instead of renting a DVD, watching it for a while, then returning it back, you would get a DVD that, after you've opened the seal and you watch it, one of the ones that was done before by FlexPlay Technologies, after 48 hours, it would degrade to the point that it wouldn't be viewable anymore.
Right.
It's a disposable DVD.
So basically you rent the DVD but never have to return it.
Right. One has been made that actually goes dark in 8 hours. And a lot of studios are going for this, trying to push it. And pushing it more for the aspect of they don't want to compete with the used DVD market and the rental market. So they're going to have this disposable DVD. And if you want one that lasts forever, you pay more.
Whoa.
So this one I'm actually just baffled by because I can't think of any technology that would spur the usage of DVD ripping technology than this.
Yeah,
that
right.
Someone would take it, rip it immediately within half an hour of them getting it home, and then have it forever and start file sharing it. And
wow. Now, of course, if you can go to any store and pick up your disc and it lasts 8 hours and it costs a buck, that's kind of cool.
That's assuming they charge a buck.
Right. They won't, of course. Thank you, Miles, for that. Sean, I'll go to you, sir, if you're ready. And
sure.
Right.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Some big news with DVD, HD, high-definition DVD. The standards body, the steering committee that...
Your phone is ringing.
Somebody forgot to turn their phone off.
Not now.
And it's my work. What do you know? Okay, so next-generation DVD drives move ahead. The steering committee that decides the DVD form, what codecs and what standards are going to be part of the next generation DVD, have approved Microsoft's VC9 technology, which is used in Microsoft Windows Media Video 9. That's what that stands for.
Okay.
That clears it up.
Yeah, now I know what they're doing.
So what's happened is MPEG-2 and MPEG-4, MPEG-2 is a current DVD standard on movies, and MPEG-4 is a lower resolution streaming version.
Right.
Those were kind of in the can. But the DVD form...
I think work really needs a shot.
Yeah, the DVD form, by approving Microsoft standard, for the first time, has approved one that is not proprietary.
Oh.
Or one that is proprietary.
The one that is proprietary.
Yeah.
Who
so
owns
not
the patent?
Quite sure.
Do you know?
Yeah, Microsoft does.
Wow, that's
kind of
creepy.
So no one's really quite sure how this is going to pan out yet. But of course, Microsoft's very happy because they plan on building their own set-top boxes and professional video editing equipment and other consumer electronics equipment. So what this means is manufacturers can now start producing manufacturing devices, HD DVD devices.
So, and that's why we haven't seen them as much, is because the standards weren't specified.
Yeah, that's why I haven't seen them at all.
That's nice. Okay, so we'll start seeing it, but Microsoft will
have a big piece of it. Hold like 20 plus gigs of data.
Right.
So that's kind of cool. But they compete with two other standards, one from China and another one from Sony. So we'll see what happens.
Great. Thank you very much, Sean. John, hi. Can't see you, but I can hear you. So
good morning. I'm over here. Okay. I really am. I'd like to touch a little bit on Mars. We talked last week about Opportunity was about to head down into a crater called the Endurance Crater, but they weren't sure if they were going to do it because it was a pretty steep angle, 25 degrees, which is a little, which is right at the limit of what they thought that the Explorer could do. So they found another ingress, which is only 19.6 degrees.
Ingress? So, oh, wait,
I'm sorry, 19.44 degrees ingress, so they can go into the crater.
Mm-hmm.
So they drove it down. Right now it's 1.3 meters into the crater. So it's officially in the crater, and it's doing exploration. They're looking at rocks. The reason
and how is this hole? Is it interesting?
It's a big hole on Mars. One of the reasons they went into it was... No, I'm not going to throw in a core reference there.
Okay.
One of the reasons I went into here is to see if inside the crater it had hit deeper into the bedrock maybe or thrown up some stuff that they weren't able to see on the surface. So, that's in the geology looking down.
I mean, it's nice because this robot, of course, is getting samples and a lot of samples. And the idea of it making a deep hole is it just can't do that. But it can find a deep hole. That's basically what...
It's a huge crater.
Right? And these rovers have portable chemistry sets, right?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, they have Mossberg spectrometers. They have everything that they could pack onto them.
They have probably more than what your high school chemistry lab had.
Yeah.
Kind of depressing, but...
But even still, even though they're so complex, they still do in about 4 or 5 days what a geologist could do in half an hour.
Right, right.
So they're not... They don't have one of those...
They
are doing what a human can do, but not as efficiently.
They don't have one of those, what are they called, human brains. So they don't have those.
Well, actually, they have a bunch of human brains controlling
just
it.
Just a long ways away.
I'm thinking maybe too many. Yeah, that's my
problem. That's the problem.
Also in Mars news, Spirit, the other rover, finally reached the Columbia Hills, which is a series of hills it was heading towards. It's just now gotten to the foothills of it, so it hasn't actually begun the exploration. Mm-hmm. But it's noteworthy in that it was a long ways away. It was several kilometers away. And it's finally reached the hills. So
traveling on Mars. Well, thank you very much for the update on our Mars exploration. Miles?
There's a worm going around Nokia Series 60 phones.
Wow.
Yeah, isn't that curious?
Is this the first phone worm?
The first that I have heard of.
Now, a worm is like a virus that propagates by itself.
Right.
Okay.
But it doesn't do any damage.
It doesn't do any damage. All it does is propagate, except... And the good news is it's very easy to find out if you have it on your phone. Which is...
The phone rings during a radio show?
No. Luckily, this worm does not do an autodialer.
Okay.
But what it does is it uses Bluetooth to communicate with other Nokia phones to be able to propagate. And as such, because the Bluetooth is constantly scanning, your battery life is shortened dramatically. So if you find your phone is a much shorter battery life than normal, then check it out. If not, you don't have it.
If you have Bluetooth and you have a Nokia phone.
Well, if you have the Series 60 phone.
It's the Series 60.
Enable.
No. Jeez, could you imagine it just goes off and dials an area code that charges $60 a minute or something?
It's crazy. It could totally have that work. Well, maybe it does. I mean, have they dissected this worm? It doesn't at a certain date do that?
That I don't know.
Okay. Wow. So basically we're talking, I mean, we've had viruses spread around on desktops and laptop computers for a long time, but seeing them in portable devices is interesting. It seems almost a little more of a personal invasion to have your phone being taken over by some remote virus.
As opposed to our personal computers, because completely...
At least the phone is, I've grown up, I've always had a phone. You know, it's like, it's kind of a different, we think about phones differently. I guess the class of 2000...
Your computer's like a fortress, you know, whereas your phone you carry with you.
Yeah.
Well, the phone's used, I mean, if you have a normal cell tower, it is. But now that we're putting in stuff like Wi-Fi and Bluetooth and other things into portable devices, they become more peer-to-peer rather than a centralized... star topography.
Yep.
Right. All right. Well, thank you very much for the update on phone worms. Sean?
Yeah, AMD has announced dual-core processors following on the heels of Intel. The Opteron chip, which is their 64-bit version, of their 64-bit processor for workstation servers, will have dual-core functionality by the end of 2005. And what that means is you won't – well, they already don't. Market their processors based on processor speed.
Right, AMD.
But Intel won't be doing that either soon. They're actually adopting BMW's numbering scheme. So there'll be 300 and 500 series processors, and BMW's endorsed that. So what's happening is a processor getting too hot. So instead of creating these really high speed, you know, cores, the idea is to create two cores, run them at a lower speed, and you get, you know, the same or more performance. So AMD announced that. And Seagate also announced a bunch of drives, a 400 gig, 3.5-inch drive for desktop.
Wow.
400 gigs.
400 gigs on your desktop.
400
gigabytes.
That's like four times.
In a 3.5-inch drive.
That's over four times what's currently available. 80 gig is the current max, right?
No, you can get 215, 300 gig now. Yeah.
For desktop? For this?
Sure, oh yeah.
For my little PowerBook?
No. That's a notebook. This is for desktop.
Oh, I'm thinking 2.5. I'm sorry. Okay, so
for notebooks, they announced a 100 gigabyte drive.
Wow.
So right now, 40, 80 gigabytes is about right for notebook. So 100 gigabyte. And then they announced a 5 gigabyte 1-inch drive for consumer
electronics. How big?
1-inch. 5 gigabyte 1-inch.
5 gigabyte. For basically?
Probably based on the CF2 standard.
Wow.
5 gigs, Bush League.
Well, Sean, thanks for the update on what's going on in the sector of compute. Well, I guess Seagate and AMD. Thanks for that.
Yep.
Miles? Or should I go to John? I'm kind of skipping John. All right.
Okay, sure.
Yeah, please.
Research firm Gartner reports, this is our doom and gloom portion of the news here. Roughly 1.98 million people reported that their checking accounts were breached in some way during the last year. The research firm said that crimes... mostly it was caused by phishing with a PH, which is where you get an email masquerading as a legitimate email saying, we need your account information, please log into the site and give us your account information. That's been the most, you know, using misleading emails
sure.
has led to roughly $2.4 billion in fraud, or an average of $1,200 per victim over the last 12 months. Also, they believe that there's another spyware called key logging. Basically, a program gets into your computer, just put in your computer,
logs
either
via
virus, and it records everything, like passwords, sensitive information. This is a company called Webroot, and they claim that one in every three PCs now harbor some kind of keystroke logging software. So,
let's just say I'm scared about that. How do I protect myself?
You can run different. Let me get out another news story. This is Vince Cerf, who is one of the guys who actually helped invent the internet. He's the guy who came up with the TCP/IP. And he recommends running, having a regime of cyber hygiene. Run filters, spam filters and all that. Also run antivirus programs. And make sure you run anti-spyware programs.
Does anyone have a good suggestion of...
Spybot. Yeah, one of the best ones out there.
So to Google, good. Type in Spybot.
Yeah.
And install that on your machine if you're concerned about key logging
software. And it's a totally free piece of software, so they're just out there helping people.
Thank you very much, John, for
a regime of...
Digital hygiene.
Cyber hygiene.
Cyber hygiene. Think of like a digital loop.
A regime of cyber hygiene.
So clean your keyboards.
That's awesome.
All right, we're going to stop the news now. And, John, I'm going to ask you for a definition, if you would, of a flash mob. What's a flash mob?
Flash mobs are sudden gatherings of people at predetermined locations at a predetermined time. People in flash mobs usually perform according to a written script, and then they disperse quickly so as not to cause a problem. Flash mobs can be for many purposes, but mostly they're groups just showing up to have fun, do one event, and then disperse.
Our guest, Greg Benson, is an associate professor of computer science at the University of San Francisco. Greg invented the name flash mob computing and proposed the first idea of wireless flash mob computers. Greg hacks the core infrastructure of flash mob runtime environment, which is the basis for the flash mob supercomputer software. Greg now joins us from home in San Francisco. Greg, welcome to Geekspeak.
Hi, great to be on.
Greg, can you turn your radio down, first of all?
I don't even have it on.
Okay, I'm having a strange sound happening, but
let me try.
I love it on Geekspeak.
Is that better?
That's much better.
All right.
I love having technical problems.
What did you do, by the way? Because we've had this problem before. Did you just turn off your speakerphone?
I switched one from one phone to another.
Wow, interesting. Oh, well, okay, well, let's get on to the subject. Greg, you was actually someone else, another professor at the University of San Francisco, had a graduate class that did something kind of unique. We're talking about that today. Built a supercomputer using multiple people as the source for the computers. Can you talk a little bit about how this idea first happened?
What you're referring to is Pat Miller, who is a lecturer at the University of San Francisco, and he taught a fairly unique class this semester called Do-It-Yourself Supercomputers. And the concept behind the class was every student in the class would build a node that would contribute to a supercomputer that they built from the ground up. So they, you know, put the motherboards together, put the power supplies together, built these blades, as we called them. And then the class was going to put the software on the supercomputer and basically carry it through from hardware to software to running
even
real applications.
Even though there'd only be a node for every member of the class, so you'd have like a 12-member node.
Yeah, computer. Exactly.
Okay, so a small supercomputer.
Supercomputer. And one thing that happened early on in the class is through a series of discussions, it came up, well, you know, how many computers would we need in this class to build a computer that could compete with the fastest computers in the world? And so Pat and his class started thinking about this, and it was clear that 16 wasn't going to be enough. So a student suggested, well, what if we put an ad on Craigslist and get a bunch of people to come to the gym for a day, bringing their computers, and we put them together, and then maybe we'd have enough computers to build something that could compete with some of the fastest computers in the world. And that was really the inception of the idea for the event, the Flash Mob 1 event that we held on April 3rd.
Okay. How many computers did you actually get with that event?
Through the door, we had 700 computers.
Wow.
We could have accommodated up to 1,200. We really didn't know what to expect. We had a registration page, and lots of people registered, more than 500 people registered, but we had, you know, people didn't show or people just dropped in.
Mm-hmm. So you've got basically, you've got all these people got together, they brought their personal computers, you put them up on desks and networked them all together using Ethernet?
That's right. We used standard fast Ethernet, so it was 100 megabit Ethernet. We had, logistically, that was an issue. We had 1.5 tons of network cable that we had to order and have delivered to accommodate 1,200 computers, we had to have all that wired up.
Was that donated?
We did have some sponsorship that offset some of that cost. Basically, we had a few corporate sponsors, and our internal IT department agreed to reuse some of the cable after we were finished.
Okay. So you get a whole bunch of people's computers together, just desktop computers. Was there a certain system requirement you had to have, something very specific?
Yeah. So what we stated, this is all back of the envelope, we put a minimum requirement of a 1.3 gigahertz Pentium 3 processor or equivalent or higher, and 256 megabytes of RAM, and that was our minimum requirement.
So that's not a machine to laugh at. That's a pretty nice machine. I mean, that's still a machine that can get you through what you need to do on a computer these days.
Right. We had to, you know, that was a fine line, because if you shoot too high, you eliminate a lot of people who bought computers in the last 3 years.
Right.
If you shoot too low, then we wouldn't have had enough muscle to have a shot at making a run at a benchmark that would show that we're fast enough.
Okay, let's step away from the technical side for a second to get a little better understanding of what flash mobs really are. Were you familiar with what a flash mob was prior to this whole endeavor?
Well, so that's where I came up with the name. I had only read about it in the paper. I was fascinated by the concept that seemingly randomly, but obviously not random, like you said in your intro, people on the internet set a predetermined place and time to meet somewhere and do something, which seems
or even just to receive instructions.
Right, exactly. That appears to be spontaneous, and that sort of captures what. The nature of a temporary supercomputer is you have a predetermined time and place. The only difference is that you're going to bring your computer and you're going to work on a perhaps scientific problem for the day and then disperse.
Now, this April event was really a test of this whole thing. You didn't actually do any scientific research with this system.
Well, as much as you tested it. So it was a test, and the program that we ran is a standard benchmark program that that actually everybody in the world uses to determine supercomputing speed.
What does it do?
Well, technically speaking, it solves a dense system of linear equations. It's something that is done regularly in many scientific applications. So you could think of it as a part of a real scientific application. And so in that sense, we were doing a real computation. It wasn't just something trivial.
Right.
But in terms of the scientific aspect of this, we learned a lot from doing this experiment and learned, the purpose was to take away from this observations and data that will help us further improve the software.
Right. So I want to talk really a little bit more detail about supercomputers, I know, crunch a lot of data, like they're really fast processors. But I don't understand what in science that you need to crunch. I mean, what are these linear equations? What would they normally represent, for example, sure. in supercomputer use?
Sure. So supercomputers are used for the most part to simulate physical phenomena. Any sort of complicated physical act, like for example, auto manufacturer might want to simulate a car crash.
Okay.
In very fine detail to see how their designs will work.
Okay.
And so you're modeling the materials and the physics that represent how a car could collide with something, and then simulating that physical event, and then getting the results from that physical event. And so the equations would represent all of that physical modeling.
Okay.
And so you can come up with lots of other examples, environmental modeling, computational chemistry, all of these things generally simulate some sort of physical reality.
From a loose perspective, we could talk about the metals that are used in the car having certain properties, and a certain force applied to them would bend them a certain way. So all those are turned into algorithms that represent those materials and how much force is applied to them, and then you just crunch through all that processing.
That's exactly right.
Okay, so that's what supercomputers do. Now, the first supercomputers we ever heard about were, Cray is a big name in supercomputers. The idea was that it was a kind of a one-processor system that would do this a lot of processing. But now you're talking about lots of little computers, people's desktop computers hooked up and calling the supercomputer. Can you talk a little bit about the difference between those two things?
Well, okay, so first, the original Cray machines, while on the surface appeared as a single computer because they were delivered in a single box, what made the original supercomputers fast is that they actually did several operations simultaneously in parallel using these very small specific processors.
Okay.
So what happened, though, is commodity machines, right, the desktops and laptops that you and I use, have outpaced, in some sense, due to economies of scale, the rate of sort of performance increase that you see in these specialized supercomputers. So it's become, essentially, laptops and desktops have become very fast, very quickly, and they're very cheap. So a lot of people now look to standard processors to put them together on a network and then program them to appear as a supercomputer.
Okay, I get that. So What that entails then is connecting these computers together and having something that figures out how to split the task up between multiple computers.
So that's a hard problem.
Yeah.
And that's what scientists and computer scientists do on a regular basis and is constantly a study of research, and that is how to take these complex problems and how to divide them up and how to take advantage of these supercomputers with many processors. And That is a difficult problem.
So you have a piece of software that's an open source project that you've probably the core developer on.
Right.
What's that called?
So it's the FlashMob system, okay. and the current snapshot can be downloaded from our website, which is www.flashmobcomputing.org. And this still is a snapshot of the software that we used on April 3rd. And this software is designed to do one thing, and that is to run the LINPACK benchmark that we ran on April 3rd. It's not designed at this point to run other applications, but that is what we're working on next, is putting together a software developer's kit so that anybody can put their applications into the FlashMob software so they can create custom FlashMob CDs and then run their own FlashMob events.
Did you write the software from scratch, or did you take it from another base? Or?
Oh, well, we did it in about 5 weeks, so we leveraged off a lot of existing software. Just to give you an idea of what constitutes a software, it's first of all, the most unique thing is it's a live CD. And I don't know if you have heard of these, but it's a Linux distribution that boots directly off the CD and doesn't touch the hard drive.
So it's like a Nopix?
It's exactly like Nopix. In fact, we used as the core a derivative of Nopix, something called Morphix. And this enabled us to create this FlashMob live CD. We tailored it so that it would boot up with just the essentials that we needed to run the LINPACK application.
We're going to get back to the subject in just a second. If people would like to join the conversation, the phone numbers are 476-2800, toll-free at 1-800-655-5877. This program is supported by a grant from Santa Cruz Electronics, offering extensive selection of computer and electronic parts as well as support services. Santa Cruz Electronics is open daily at 2808 Soquel Avenue and online at santacruzelectronics.com. We are speaking with Professor of Computer Science from San Francisco University, Greg Benson, about supercomputers made from multiple desktop machines. We're going to continue this discussion. Please stay with us.
I'm Renee Montaigne. Ray Charles was one of those rare people who had a talent for joy. Groovy, hit the road, Jack, Georgia. His music always entertained us and often inspired us, too. Join us, along with Stevie Wonder, Billy Preston, Glenn Campbell, and Wynton Marsalis, at the Ray Charles Memorial Service, direct from the First AME Church in Los Angeles, from National Public Radio.
Tonight at 6 on Central Coast Public Radio, KUSP.
This week on This American Life, we toured to 5 cities doing our show on stage. People paid good money, though you can hear the show for free and find out why, among other things. People laugh after writer Sarah Vowell says this sentence.
This is the one clear-cut case where you can ask yourself, what would Jesus do? And you know the answer.
Also, letters found on the street, John Langford of the Mekons, OK Go, and more.
This American Life, Sunday at 10 a.m. on Central Coast Public Radio, KUSP.
We're speaking with Greg Benson today on GeekSpeak about supercomputers. You can join the conversation. The phone numbers are 476-2800 or toll-free at 1-800-655-5877. You can also join the conversation by going to geekspeak.org, click on The Geeks, then click on Send a Message. This program is supported by a grant from Cruise.io, providing Internet services including DSL, spam filters, PHP, MySQL. Now with nationwide access, information about Cruise.io membership is available online at cruise.io.com or by calling 459-6301. This is Central Coast Public Radio, KUSP. You're listening to GeekSpeak. My name is Lyle Troxell. In the air with me are geeks Miles Elam, John Tracy, and Sean Cleveland. We are speaking with Greg Benson about supercomputers made using flash mobs, people organizing kind of through the Internet together to do something, normally something kind of ridiculous, this time something relatively useful, a supercomputer. Greg, the software that actually runs this, I understand that you put on a CD, so no one has to actually install anything, so any computer will work, but in the pictures that I saw of this event, there's no monitors or keyboards hooked up to these computers. How does that work out?
Right. So part of what we did when configuring these CDs is we made it so that it boots up without requiring the keyboard or a monitor. And its whole job when it boots up is to identify itself and become available to a server so that the server will recognize that, okay, this computer is now up and running. We can now use it in a flash mob computation. So the boot up sequence is very simple, and its whole job is to get on the network. And we don't need monitors to do that, which is quite nice.
Now, when you say identify yourself, I'm assuming these CDs were just massively produced. I mean, you had to have at least 600 of these CDs. 12 of these CDs because they have to be in the machine when it's running. So you make these mass disks and you put them in a computer. How does that computer then identify itself uniquely to the central core system?
Right. The way we did that is to use a standard software called DHCP, and essentially using the same technique that most networks use now to give out dynamic IP addresses. What happens is a computer comes online, it sends out a broadcast message over the network saying, I'm up, I need an IP address, please give me one. Our server that we control gives out an IP address and then logs this information that it's given an IP address to that computer. And then we use that information on the server to know that this computer is up and running.
Now, even though there's a whole bunch of computers and most of them are duplications, you do have one machine at least that's a server. What is
correct.
It? What is its task in this flash mob computing paradigm?
So when you boot up the CD, by default it boots up as a compute node. But you can change, you can alter that. You can select via a menu option to turn one of the computers into a server. And the point of having a server is you need to have some place where you can start the applications. That is, this is going to be the node sort of controls the whole flash mob computer. And you can do other things too, like maybe configure the system if you know, for example, you have all Pentium 4s, or if you have if you know something about the computers that are involved, you can optimize a little bit to make the application run a little faster. But the server is something that you'd want a monitor attached to so that you could enter commands, start the application, and get the results.
One of the interesting things I hear about supercomputers being used for, or it always comes around when you talk about encryption. So there's certain types of encryption, and people ask, well, how secure is my data if I encrypt it this way? And the answer is, well, if you had the world's fastest computer and you had 12 months on the time of that on that computer, then you could crack this. That's kind of like the standard way of answering about encryption, how secure it is. It has to do with how long it would take computers to crack it. Could you conceptually make, using flash mob technology, a supercomputer with 4,000 nodes that would be able to crack encryption really, really fast?
The answer is you could definitely, people do that currently. You could use a network of computers to try to break a code, and in fact, people are doing that over the internet right now. There's something called distributed.net, and that's what they do, is they use computers over the network to try to break, see what kind of code they can break. They're not doing this maliciously. They're doing it just to show what's possible. It would be conceivable to put some computers together to try to break codes. However, it's a race right now. Basically, the encryption schemes are trying to stay ahead of the speed of computers, so that, you know, as computers get faster, the schemes get harder to break, so that hopefully you can't, you know, build something that will break something easily. It can be done.
Please join our conversation. The phone numbers are 476-2800 or toll-free at 1-800-655-5877. You're welcome to talk to us about supercomputers, how this program worked, flash mobs. If you've ever been in a flash mob, please give us a ring. Let us know how it went. And if you just have questions about how maybe you could participate in scientific research with your computer, please join our conversation. The phone numbers are 476-2800 or toll-free at 1-800-655-5877. All right, Greg, how this event in April turn out? You said that you got about 700 computers. You were ready for 1,300 or so. How did it happen?
Well, we set up some computers the night before, some of our own local computers, and we opened the doors at 8, and we then got our total of about 700 set up by 11 a.m. That's when we said, we shut the doors, and we said, okay, we're going to start running the experiment.
Wait, I'm sorry, you got 700 computers hooked up, plugged in, and I'm assuming ready to power on in how much time? In 2 hours?
In about 3 hours.
About 3 hours.
We had a couple hundred set up before 8 a.m.,
uh-huh.
So it was probably something on the order of 400 to 500 computers that we set up.
Now,
we had a lot of volunteers.
Now, the people that came and brought their machines, were they also setting them up? Is that what they were doing?
The way that worked is we had a registration process. We wanted to be very careful that people who volunteered their computers were ensured that they would get their equipment back at the end of the day. So we would tag their computers, and they would have a password and a unique badge that would only allow them to walk out with their machine. Mm-hmm. So the process was you'd register, you bring your computer to the gym, and we had a secure area where you would walk in with a volunteer who would guide you to a table and would help you set up your computer and make sure that it could boot the CD properly. And then the participant was asked to leave. We couldn't have 700 participants sort of hanging around in the gym, and then they would leave. And we had various activities for people to do outside of the gym during the day, but that's how things got started.
How did you test whether the computer could run and boot the CD?
Put it in and boot it.
And you had a monitor or not?
We really encourage people to bring laptops.
Uh-huh.
If somebody brought a desktop, then we would have to test it locally. We would temporarily put a monitor in just to see if it came up.
Okay, I see. All right, so you got about 700 computers. They were all plugged in by 11. How'd the test go?
So it went well. We ended up, our best result was 180 gigaflops. That was using 256 of the 700 machines, and that took about an hour and a half to run. Unfortunately, that didn't run to completion. It finished about 75% of the way through because a node failed. And that was the main weakness of our software and of the application that we ran, is that once it's running, if any computer in the network fails, the whole application fails. So you have to hope that it's going to run without problems. So
you put that number out, or that metric, a gigaflop.
Yeah, let me.
What's
so
that?
That's billions of floating point operations per second, and that's the unit of measure that's currently used to assess supercomputer performance. It's how many additions or subtractions or multiplications you can do in a second. So
of a number with a decimal in it.
Exactly.
You did. So wait, how many did you get to do?
The best number that we got was 180 gigaflops. And if you look at the top 500 fastest computers in the world, the low end of that top 500 list, that is the 500th fastest computer, was about 405 gigaflops.
So you got a quarter of what?
Almost half, but so, yeah, oh. Third. Let's say now almost half of the slowest on the top 500. That would have put us on the top 500, say, 2 years ago.
Now this is again. It was the number you got was 180. You say
gigaflops.
180 billion
floating point operations per second.
So that's like multiplying two decimal point numbers together. You can do 180 billion of those per second.
That's exactly right.
That's kind of astounding. That's actually even faster than Miles' arithmetic in his head.
It's pretty fast.
That's fast.
Yeah.
Wow. Well, we got a call from John in Hollister. John, welcome to Geek Speak. We don't have a call from John. I love technology. Isn't it great? All right. Well, then we'll go on. Miles, do you have any questions? Or Sean, please.
I have a question. Flash mobs are a really big thing in New York. And I'm wondering, did you hear from any of the people who had organized flash mob events over there?
Well, after the event, we have actually talked to some people in New York who seem enthusiastic about organizing the next flash mob supercomputer in New York, and we're actively talking with them, and hopefully we can get something going. But in terms of prior to the event, we didn't talk to anybody in New York specifically.
So what do you see as a potential application of this? Like, where's an area that isn't being recognized or being adequately dealt with that a flash mob could deal with?
Right. So there's a couple of things. One thing that I think got everybody got excited about, and including us, is supercomputers are still fairly esoteric machines. They're things that are really only owned and operated by large government labs and large corporations. They're not something that that an ordinary citizen has normal access to. What that means is it means that people don't have a lot of control over the types of programs that are run on those supercomputers. And what we tried to show is that it is feasible for people using their own computers to put something together that can do some serious computation. This then means that people can choose what kinds of science they run on their own supercomputers. And while it might be a little ways off the AIDS life cycle, not only does, you know, the ride from San Francisco to Los Angeles, but they might actually get people to also bring along computers and do AIDS research at the same time. That's sort of the direction that we're heading in, is that now you have this resource, right? People have, you know, hundreds of thousands of computers sitting out there not really doing anything. Now they can put them to work.
There's SETI at Home and a bunch of other organizations out there.
That's right.
That in SETI is a Search for Extraterrestrial Life that use computers that are hooked to the Internet. And is the Internet something that could be used as a backbone for one of these, for a supercomputer?
That was the main reason for having the computers physically located, is for the types of problems that we were interested in working on. They're so-called tightly coupled problems. They're problems that require lots of interaction between the processors.
One machine's output actually feeds the next,
exactly,
next processing of
exactly.
Some other thing.
Exactly. These types of applications don't really work on the current Internet, just because the delays are unpredictable and they're still quite slow relative to what kind of speed you get on a local area network. So
what about a local area network like a university that its primary focus is education and research? What about just using all the desktop computers of that university at night when people aren't using it to do this kind of processing?
Yeah, actually, researchers have been doing this for a while.
Yeah.
What our software does that makes this a little bit easier is previous researchers have tried to install software on people's desktops, that is on their Windows machines or Linux machines, so that at night those machines could be used to do some sort of computation. The problem is that you have to install that software, and you have a variety of different machines and Windows versions and Linux versions, and it's still a little bit cumbersome. Our solution, what you would do is you'd walk in, and people who would want to participate, you'd throw in the CD, maybe, you know, 50 computers, you'd boot it up, they would work on the application using a dedicated operating system, dedicated software environment, and in the morning, they simply reboot, and they have their original machine back. So we've, in some sense, simplified the process of running applications.
Right, whereas I couldn't see a general community wanting to do weather simulations, but at the same time, some particular group of physics grad students, for example, might just spontaneously say, oh, you need to work on this problem. Everybody bring your computers over to Joe's house.
That's right. That's right.
Okay.
What about a situation, you talked about modeling a car accident. What about I would assume that modeling that information, that kind of information, you could theoretically use in litigation as well. So what about, do you see this being used in a lot of different places, not just at universities or by individuals?
In fact, I've had conversations with people in large corporations who, you might have a company that wants to do some sort of economic optimization. They have a model of their particular business, and you know they don't want to pay somebody, but they have a lot of computers because they have a huge IT infrastructure. Perhaps twice a year they'd want to use the collective power of their computers to give them some sort of direction, perhaps in cost savings or allocation, and they could do that twice a year very easily just by transforming their computers into a temporary supercomputer.
So that's the thing that's interesting to me, that my first reaction is that it's going to be really useful for business like that, and then theoretically it could be used in schools research. But you mentioned, and I hadn't even thought of it, like AIDS research being used for this purpose. There seems to be a lot of people that are interested in supporting research on AIDS, and the AIDS walks are a perfect example of that. A lot of people get together and spend their time, so to also spend their computer time to do that as well makes sense. But what kind of research can be done about AIDS technology using supercomputers?
So I am certainly not an expert in AIDS research, but things like DNA sequencing, genetic sequencing to determine how viruses work, or how I understand that's the type of applications that are targeted.
And all this kind of like genetic sequencing and figuring out how viruses work, that all comes down to multiplication, division, adding, subtraction of floating point numbers.
Some of it, yes.
It seems weird to me that, I mean, I guess from a computer science perspective, the world, simulating the world, comes down to equations. Just, it seems kind of strange to talk that way. You think normally research is done by people thinking and doing maybe guesswork, but there seems to be a lot of it now that is just number crunching.
Right. Well, so computers are becoming, computers are getting faster every year or every month, and the types of things that they can model are getting more sophisticated. So eventually, rather than doing physical experiments, which will still be done, if we can do, 1,000 times more experiments, but in a virtual simulation rather than in a real simulation, you can imagine that this will be a significant advantage to scientists, because they can do a lot more experiments than they could do otherwise.
Yeah, something just came to mind, which was, it might also be interesting for folks that are doing digital media production. For example, a poor man's render farm.
That's a great example. You're an independent filmmaker. You don't have access to Pixar's large pool of computers, but you have a great idea and you want to do a small film. Why not have a weekend where you get your friends together to help you render part of your film? Definitely.
And that way you don't have to, like, actually do the outlay of buying all of those computers. You just say, can I borrow that for a couple of days?
That's exactly right. That's exactly right.
Greg, this the system that you built off of some Linux stuff that already existed, that basically most of the stuff that you used was, like, the detection of hardware and how to, the drivers necessary for network cards, and then also just the idea of running a computer from a disk. And then you also put an application on top of that. And the application on top of that you mostly wrote. How complicated is it?
Well, so let me clarify. What we wrote specifically was a lot of the glue software, the software that once Linux was up and running, how do we then configure all the machines to prepare them to run the Linpack benchmark? And so a lot of the software we wrote, which was some C code, some Python scripts, some shell scripts, all of this stuff helped prepare the FlashMob computer in order to run this Linpack benchmark.
Because the Linpack benchmark was already written.
That software was written. We did modify it. One way we modified it was to give us some status information to tell us how it's doing. Because in its original form, you would just run it. You'd wait for 2 hours and hopefully get a result. We wanted to have some feedback to indicate, well, how fast is it running and how far along is it? So we did some modifications so that it would give us some feedback. If things were going wrong, if we weren't getting the performance we wanted, we could stop it and then start it again.
Have you had any people that are actually using this now for research or about to or moving along on this project besides just testing it?
So we certainly have generated a lot of interest, and perhaps this is speculation, but probably more people have run the Linpack benchmark at home than than anybody else previously, just because there's so few supercomputers. And now what we've done is we've made a CD that you just plop into your home network, and now you can see the performance of the computers on your home network. My dad downloaded the CD and installed it in his home network and got a gigaflops rating. And we get feedback from people all over the world that are doing the same. In its current form, though, all it does is run the Linpack benchmark and give you this gigaflops rating. So our job is to come up with the process by which people can create their own custom flash mob CDs. And that's going to be the real exciting part, is when you can download a flash mob CD from our website or somewhere else that does something that you're interested in. Like, say I live in Santa Cruz and I want to do modeling of the bay or modeling of the groundwater, right, in my local area. Now, that would be really exciting.
So I have a question for you. Since you hooked up 700 computers and got 180 gigaflops, is there an upper limit to the number of computers that you can connect together? Or, for example, at one point do you actually need to go to gigabit Ethernet? And at what point is gigabit Ethernet not enough? I mean,
yes, there is. It is true that as you increase the number of computers, you put more stress on the network. And so as you increase the number of computers, your network has to either become faster or more sophisticated in how it connects up the computers. We were fortunate. On April 3rd, we had Foundry Networks loaned us one of their high-end switches that had very large network capacity. This helped us out quite a bit. Certainly, gigabit would be great. For our experiment, though, most laptops don't come with gigabit at this point, although they're starting to.
Except for Apple's.
Yeah, exactly. The answer is yes. The network can become a problem. And this is a problem that not only flash mobs have to deal with, but large supercomputers also have to deal with. And this is a big area of research, is how to allow the network to accommodate a very large number of computers.
Well, let's say that the auditorium that you had could hold more than 1,200. Do you have an idea of, like, how far this could go, how many computers you could do as a potential with the existing technology with 10 megabit?
So it's dependent on a couple of things. If you're asking how far could we have gone with fast Ethernet and the application that we are running, we'd probably top out at the 12 to 1,500 computer range.
And at 12 to 1,500, how many gigaflops potentially do you
wow.
think get?
Well, we were estimating in the 500 to 550 range, so 500 to 550 gigaflops.
That's good. Now, the top processor at this point is an average of 35,860 gigaflops per second.
Right.
So it's a little ways away from that, but it's still impressive. We're out of time, unfortunately, on GeekSpeak. Gray Wolf Computer Systems has provided a grant in support of this program. Gray Wolf Computer Systems offers custom computer systems and personalized service for repairs, upgrades, and networks in the East Cliff Village Shopping Center in Santa Cruz. Our guest today, Greg Benson. Research includes parallel computing, operating systems, and programming languages. Greg, thank you very much for joining us today on GeekSpeak. If you want to learn more about Greg's research and this whole flash mob computing, you can go to flashmobcomputing.org or go to geekspeak.org and click on today's show. The geeks today were Miles Elam, Sean Cleveland, and John Tracy. Our producer is Maggie Cleveland. Thank you all for participating today on GeekSpeak.
Good to be here.
Thank you.
Of course, next week we'll be back again to do a program of answering calls and questions. This is GeekSpeak for Central Coast Public Radio, KUSP Santa Cruz, KDBH San Arto, or on the web at kusp.org. Fine Print is coming up next, followed by State of the Arts with my mother, Diana Wright Troxell, and at noon, Two Steps in the Blues with Charlie Lang. For KUSP and GeekSpeak, I'm Lyle Troxell. Stay tuned now for Fine Print.